TalkZone presents Money at Work, the weekly show that addresses the issues of the day from a financial perspective. Now, here are your hosts, Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this January 23rd, 2014 edition of Money at Work with OB Capital on TalkZone.com. I'm Brian Bourdon. I'm going to be joined shortly by my co-host and partner, Steve Memory. First, let you know that OB Capital Management is a registered investment advisory located in Alexandria, Virginia, and subject to all the rules and regulations governing registered investment advisories in the Commonwealth. In today's program, we're going to be discussing interest rate movements. We've seen some of that lately. We want to talk about how they affect dividend-paying stocks. Is now a good time to be in dividend-paying stocks, particularly? And we also want to take a look at fixed income in this little bit of an uptick we're having, particularly municipal bonds, treasuries, those kinds of investments. Are those things that we want to be getting involved in? And after that, we're going to take a look at several stocks, some of which we are invested in for ourselves and our clients, some of which we're not, and we'll let you know which ones are which as we get to that. But as always, when we're discussing stocks, when we're discussing any kind of investments on the program, you need to make sure you're talking with your personal investment advisor to make sure that these investments are appropriate for your portfolio. They should match up with what your advisor has planned for you. First, though, we're going to take a look at some of the major indices out there. We're noticing that we've had a downturn pretty much for the most of the week. The Dow's down about 1.3%. The S&P's off about 1.25%. The Nasdaq's down a point. So everybody's involved in this. This really comes on news. A lot of concern about what's going on in China. Their growth seems to have backed off some, although it's still fairly substantial growth. It has backed down. And the market's also mulling the quarterlies from companies like McDonald's and Netflix. Now these reports haven't necessarily been bad. They haven't been great. They've basically been uninspired. And Steve, what I guess the question is this being used as an excuse by institutional traders who have been wanting to take something off the table all along, or is this possibly indicative of more of a spiraling effect? What are you seeing? What's your opinion on that?
Well, right now we have, a couple of hundred points down on the Dow. We've had a substantial run up. Like we've talked about this. We talked about this last week. Anytime you have a 30%+ run up in the market, and then you follow that with a little denouement after the euphoria of that kind of a gain, and everybody's looking for valuations and earnings essentially to back up the high multiples that we have, and the idea being that if we can sustain higher earnings, then we can sustain growth in the overall marketplace. The expectations for everyone for this particular market have been lowered just as well. We, just along with everybody else, have been out there saying that we don't expect the same kind of earnings returns this year, but we're looking at more normalized returns. Last year was a wonderful gift. It was an aberration, but it was nice to go ahead and have. But fundamentals are going to drive the valuations of the overall market, and they're going to drive the valuations of the individual stocks. And we have to pay attention to those. So when we see earnings come out and earnings are mixed, what we have is a circumstance where it allows people, if you will, the opportunity to go ahead and think maybe they need to retrench or pull back or take profits. And you're more likely to go ahead and take those profits in the early part of the year. Particularly if we see the possibility of further retrenchment, further things pulling back, it makes sense to go ahead and want to, set your bar, if you will, to say, okay, at this point in time, I'm going to take some cash off the table and then look for bargains. China is, China is still a communist country. Let's not forget. We go ahead and we talk about what is China doing? What are their, what's their economy doing? They're not an open society. you know, China still has a fairly substantial, big, you know, heavy hand in their economic development. And it is, you know, the reporting of their earnings is subject to the vagaries and whims of the people involved. That's not to go ahead and say that I think China is fudging the numbers. But let's just say that, you know, in communist countries, we have known in the past for things to be a little more optimistic than not. And if you're looking for opportunities to go ahead and bring numbers back into line, it's not unusual to see in this kind of environment a circumstance where they would start to show a little pullback in what their economy is doing. No economy can go ahead and remain on fire forever. Things just don't move in a straight line.
Well, I was going to say they have been doing, as far as we know, as you pointed out rather well, as far as we know, the information we're giving says that they have been going along at a really good clip, and that we've seen it here. You can't sustain that forever. There are very few things that can be maintained at that velocity for a long period of time. So maybe this is kind of a natural easing of their marketplace, just kind of a natural, kind of settling down, reversion to the mean then.
Sure. And look, to get all theoretical on everything here, and I'm going to do this. I promise not to bring the Templars into it. But look, capitalism really grew up primarily in the United States, and it grew up as the United States grew up. The concepts of capitalism involve the same concepts of liberty and freedom in which the United States itself was developed. That classic liberalism of freedom of the individual. And capitalism itself is based upon this idea that we have the individual freedom to be able to go ahead and go out into the marketplace and make a selection and choose among products. We have the ability as producers to go ahead and choose to compete in any particular area that we wish to make a go of it. Okay, the basic concept of capitalism is choice and individuality and freedom. And as much as people back in 2008 tried to go ahead and declare China as being this fabulous new model that we should all try to emulate, some kind of benevolent hand guiding the marketplace, the fact remains that capitalism, with its ability to generate high multiples for gross domestic growth, for GDP growth, the ability to go ahead and see real returns to the bottom line of any given country as well as any given company, is inexorably intertwined with the liberties of individual people. You can't go ahead and say, hey, I want to have a free market but an enslaved population. Okay. Yeah. And we will see this in China. And there are areas that are butting up against those two things are butting up against each other. The question for China is, in order to sustain this wonderful growth that it has seen, that it has wanted to go ahead and use to benefit itself from a socialistic standpoint, it needs further freedoms and further capitalism to go ahead and create that. And so trying to balance those two things out is not an easy task.
Okay, so that's what we're seeing in the market. That is partially responsible for maybe some of the equity money leaving the markets. Now, how much of the equity money leaving the markets do you think is related to the uptick we're seeing in interest rates? Is the money going to leave the market to get into fixed income? There's been a dearth of fixed income, as you well know, over the last couple of years. There just hasn't been anything that's been out there for the conservative investor to really, you know, kind of lick their lips about. So now, if we're seeing an uptick in interest rates, is it possible that some of the money's exiting the market because that's where it's going to find its home, on the fixed income side of the ledger?
Well, I don't know that yet we're seeing any kind of mass exodus of equities and moving into fixed income. I just don't see that at this point in time. Look, there's been a lot of talk. There was a substantial amount of talk, particularly over the summer, over something that we coined the term the Great Rotation. I'm not saying that we here at OV Capital coined that term. I'm saying that we in the investment community have come to accept this term, the Great Rotation. The theory or the concept behind the Great Rotation was that money that was in fixed income was going to be facing a significant pressure once the government started tapering. And once the federal board ceased buying the large quantities of fixed income it did every month and stopped propping up the prices, that what we would see is a fall in prices, a rise in rates, and that in an effort to go ahead and shield themselves from this, people would rotate out of fixed income and into equities. I think largely what we're seeing is a rotation more along the line of from certain fixed income into other certain fixed income, the idea being to go ahead and minimize the overall impact on a fixed income portfolio. And I think that's more likely than to go ahead and just see wholesale dumping into the equity market, which, you know, you could argue that we saw some of that in the past quarter, but really it wasn't there. It's not substantiated by what we see in cash flows. There was not a significant movement that went from cash to equity. There may have been a circumstance where fixed income moved into cash, but not necessarily moving from fixed income to equity.
Well, good, because I think that basically says that any of the money that's coming out now is basically going to stay maybe a little bit on the sideline looking for a buying opportunity. I know we were talking about this earlier, that there are certain companies we've had our eye on that we'd like to re-enter or maybe get involved with, and we're waiting for the right price to come along, and that could be a lot of folks in that same boat.
Absolutely. There are a number of equity positions that are out there, and we always like to look for a good buying opportunity, and this is starting to shape up to be one of them. But one of the additional things we wanted to go ahead and take a look at here coming up, I think after the break, is that what are the impacts of a rising interest rate environment, particularly on the bonds that are held out there? Because everybody has this question, okay, well, we know the Fed is going to start tapering. We already know that they have been doing that this month, and that the indications are in all likelihood that that will continue and maybe even increase despite what we see if there's some question about unemployment numbers. But the question is what kind of impact does that have on the individual bond or fixed income positions that we're holding? And that's something I think that after the break, we'd like to go ahead and come back to.
Well, I'd like to do that too, because I think it's important for us to also delve into what happens next. Is this something that we can sort of plan on? Is this something that's going to be happening going forward, or is this something that's going to be driven kind of by headlines in the most recent reports? But like you said, we'll get back into that on the other side of the break. You're listening to Money at Work from OV Capital Management on TalkZone.com.
Welcome back to Money at Work on TalkZone. Here's Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon.
Thanks, and welcome back to the second segment of Money at Work here on at OV Capital on TalkZone.com. Before we went to the break, we had been talking about the effect that the recent kind of small uptick in interest rates has had on fixed income, in particularly the treasuries. We were going to look at municipals. So, Steve, why don't you pick up with that and give us your thoughts on that?
Well, one of the things we always talk to people about is, particularly when we're dealing with fixed income or bonds, or in particular bonds, is that when we're looking at prices and yields, we have a sort of a seesaw analogy that we use, and that is that as You can have prices on one side of the bond seesaw and yields on the other. So when we see an increase in prices, what we see is a decline in yields. And we're all kind of familiar with the declining yield environment. And many folks have gone ahead and seen substantial increases in their portfolios, particularly conservative investors who've had a lot of bonds. And they say, hey, I've been doing great. Look at my portfolio. It's wonderful. See, I didn't need to be in equities. I've got this fantastic bond portfolio. And look how wonderful I'm doing. That appreciation, that capital appreciation in a fixed income instrument, comes specifically because of the decline in yields. The problem, of course, is that when yields start to increase, we see a climbing effect on those yield prices. The actual opposite happens, and that is that bond prices start to decline. One of the things we always talk to folks is that where a stock has a theoretical unlimited upside, okay, that's not to say that there isn't a relationship with fundamentals or any other kind of earnings that drive a stock price. All we're saying is that theoretically, if a company earns enough, its stock price can go as high as it wants. There is no real cap. With a bond instrument, however, that's not necessarily the case, simply because interest rates can only go to zero for that particular bond issue. And at that point in time, the maximum value of that bond will be achieved. Okay, so a 5% bond, a bond that comes out at par at $100 and is priced with a 5% yield, when interest rates go to zero, it's going to have its maximum amount of capital appreciation, at which time all of the risk then for that particular bond is on the downside. That is to say that if yields go up, the price will come down. But if yields go down farther, you're not likely to go ahead and have people spend negative or have a negative interest rate, which is to say that, okay, say your 5% yielding bond, and now all of a sudden we see a 10% drop in bond prices. You're not going to have people pay an additional 5% to collect 5% less on their investment with a fixed income. Okay, that may be a complex way of saying it. But if you think of the analogy that at some point in time, that seat on the seesaw will hit the ground, and that's all it's going to do. And that's what we've seen really effectively. When we take a look at what the correlation is now between a 1% increase in bond yields and how that affects the underlying price of the bond, that's when we start to go ahead and see significant impact and can see significant impact on portfolios. And this is one of the things that we talk to a lot of our conservatively oriented clients about, that just because you're in a fixed income, just because you're in a bond, does not mean that it is conservative. For example, if you have a 5-year treasury, U.S. Treasury bond that's out there, a 1% increase in interest rates will have a 4.9% decline effect on the overall value, that is the principal amount, that is the actual dollar amount that that bond is worth. Okay, and that can be fairly substantial. So if you have $100,000 in a particular bond, all of a sudden you see your bond go down to $95,000. $5,000 loss simply because interest rates went up that 1%. And if we're looking at a circumstance where the target yield on interest rates is 2 or 3% higher, you can see how this can have a significant impact. The other thing to be very concerned about is the duration. When we talk about, hey, here's the impact on a 5-year treasury, what happens if you go out to 10 years? Well, that 4.9% impact now becomes an 8.9% impact. And a lot of people went ahead and bought these long-term bonds, okay, when people weren't being able to go ahead and get the kind of yields that they were looking for in the bond market. The only way to get yield was to go out farther on the yield curve. If people would buy a bond, say, gee, you know what, this 2%, this 1%, this 0.75% really stinks. How do I get my 4%? And if their broker said, well, hey, here's a nice 4% bond. Let me go ahead and sell it to you. He takes a nice commission. The spread on the whole bond is fairly substantial, and you just bought yourself a 30-year bond. The problem is interest rates move 1%, and you see an 18.2% correlation to the downside on the actual principal value of your bond.
And that's where the risk has come in. With fixed income over the last couple of years, and we have talked to many of our conservative investors here telling them that, I've heard you say it several times, that the equity markets really have not been as risky as the fixed income markets have been, especially when you're looking long term for the reasons that you just enumerated.
Absolutely. Well, you don't have to go back too far in modern history here to recall a time when we were getting 4% on a money market. Okay. So you think about the amount, 1% on a money market, if you think about it, was a decent yield. Everybody figured, okay, I can get 1%. And my money is pretty liquid. But now you're sitting there in a 5-year, well, not quite a 5-year, but you get a 2-year treasury, and you're looking at less than 0.5%. You're looking at about 38 to 40 basis points, the basis points being a percent of a percent. So 40 basis points being 0.4% interest rate. You know, and that's on a 2-year, you got to hold something 2 years and you get 0.4%. I mean, that's not much. And that's locking it up. That's not even on a money market rate. That's a 2-year treasury.
Well, and I think that's illustrative of the creativity that money managers have had to employ over the last couple of years in building portfolios in a place like this, in a registered investment advisory like OV Capital Management. We have what's called an investment policy statement. We have to know our client. We have to know their risk tolerance. So I guess the textbook would tell you, if you have a client who is conservative, you want to be 50% fixed income, 60% fixed income. Well, going over the course of the last couple of investment years, that has not necessarily yielded the most conservative type of portfolio.
Absolutely. And, one of those things that we talk about, the ability to go ahead and create fixed income, or create a portfolio that is diversified doesn't necessarily mean you have to have a bond. Okay. You can diversify a portfolio through a number of different areas, but you have to be on top of these things. You have to manage them because the risk is out there, particularly when we talk about a circumstance where interest rates are in a rising environment after they have been in a substantial declining environment. Look, there have been a number of years for people to get used to this low interest rate environment. There are a number of years under our belt for people to go ahead and get complacent about their portfolios. Okay. And there have been a number of, I don't want to talk bad about anybody, but in any industry, there are people who A, either don't know what they're doing, or B, think they're doing the right thing when they're doing the wrong thing. And C, there's always pressure on people in an industry in a sales environment. And, the difference between someone who's in a brokerage firm versus someone who's in an RIA is that there is a sales relationship in that brokerage firm. That's the nature of a brokerage. And there's always pressure to go ahead and generate revenue, particularly when you're talking in the 08, 09 environment. So one of the ways that people, we see it a lot, where people went ahead and made money and were able to make revenue and act like they were doing the right thing for their clients, was to put them into long-term bonds. The argument goes something like, well, hey, as long as you hold it to maturity, you're not going to lose your money. Well, assuming, of course, that it pays out and assuming, of course, that there's no default, that's true. But the question of opportunity cost is out there. Okay, when you went ahead and you have locked in for the next 30 years with a substantial portion of your portfolio, a 2%, rate of return, when inflation, while currently low now, at some point in time is likely to increase back up to about the 3% range, you have gone ahead and locked yourself into an underperforming asset. And your broker took a substantial cut for it, because that spread out there that you see when you buy a bond, Okay. The commission is built into the spread. That is, it's built into the amount of money that is paid for on the one hand and the amount of money that the bond was purchased for on the other. Okay. So there's a substantial difference, and there's the longer a bond goes, the more or the greater the spread, the more money goes into the pocket of the broker. You know, it's a recipe for our, some significant problems.
Well, I think it's interesting that you mentioned opportunity cost, because that's like the – you made the seesaw analogy earlier, and the kind of the other end of the seesaw of that opportunity cost is interest rate risk. Basically, when you have one, you've got the other, meaning that your money's tied up in a long-term investment that's not paying you that great, and now you don't have the money on hand to take advantage of rising interest rate, which costs you that opportunity.
Right, absolutely. And to make matters worse, when that happens, you're faced with a situation in order to get yourself out of that long-term bond, that long-term lockup, is that you have to take a significantly lower amount of money if you try to sell. You know, and you have, in order to realize that you end up realizing that 18% loss, and quite possibly even more, because the next person out there trying to go ahead and buy it from you doesn't want to find themselves in the same circumstance.
Well, that siren that went by was going to pick up somebody, I'm sure, who has a 30-year bond and has been paying attention to the news. You might have heard that go by the window. I know you kind of looked at me like it was somehow my fault when that went by, but I swear I had nothing to do with it. But that's important for folks to know. Really, it is, because you can't just, you know, I'm in fixed income, I'm fine. You know, I'm conservative because I'm in fixed income. And that's what we've really been trying to do here for the last several minutes is kind of let you know that you're out there listening, you're looking at your portfolio. You know, make sure, take a look at your fixed income. What do you have? Have someone explain it to you. Make sure that you know what you're in, because it's like when we do things here. I mean, Steve, when you're looking at a company and you're determining whether or not you want to buy it, you're looking at, if I could afford it, would I buy this whole thing? It's important. Absolutely. It's important for you to know out there what you have, why you have it, and that's key. What we want to get to at the other side of the break, and Steve, if you want to finish up on any fixed income, we can do that at that time, but wanted to kind of get into some of your impressions on the equity markets, and in particular some of the sectors within the equity markets that may or may not be good opportunities coming up, and why. Not necessarily things that we own, but maybe things we'd like to, or maybe things we want folks to watch out for. But we're going to hit that on the other side of our half-hour break. You're listening to Money at Work from OV Capital Management. We're on TalkZone.com.
And now, more of Money at Work on TalkZone.com. Here's Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon.
Thanks. Welcome back. This is Brian Bourdon. I'm joined, as always, by Steve Memory. And before we went to break, we had been talking about fixed income vehicles, what the rising interest rate environment might mean to that, and what it can mean typically for fixed income in a rising rate environment. And Steve, I know there were a couple of points you wanted to make. We were going to get into some equities in a few minutes, but wanted to give you an opportunity to just kind of finish your thoughts on what we've been talking about in the first couple segments there.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Brian. One of the things I just want to point out, of course, is that we were talking about, you know, somebody buying a 30-year bond that's out there, and of course we had the siren, and we kind of made a joke out of that. It's not illegal for your broker to go ahead and sell you a 20, 30-year bond. Okay, we have to keep that in mind, that this is not something that is, you're not going to run into SEC issues if you've purchased this. There are ways of being able to go ahead and justify this, and there are reasons for certain portfolios to own those bonds. It's just in most of the cases that we have come across with folks, we find that it's maybe a little lazy some cases, but in most cases it's not what we would consider to be the most appropriate or the best alternative for people to be buying when interest rates are as low as they are, long-term fixed income. Now, I know a lot of people, we get this, and we, you know, have people that say, hey, wait a minute, look, I just picked up a municipal bond, and you're talking about, you know, real low interest rates, because my municipal bond out there, I got 3% on a yield, and it wasn't that long. And, yeah, that's exactly right. The average length of duration for most municipals at this point in time is about 9.9 years. You know, so you're looking at about a 10-year duration. You're getting 3% or so on that bond. The tax equivalent yield on that, of course, can be pretty substantial, but depending upon what your overall tax rate is. Obviously, if you have a very high tax rate, you're better off, buying a municipal bond that, with a 10-year duration than a shorter duration high yield. But what our point is that you still have to be aware that when interest rates are rising, it will have an impact on the value of your portfolio, which is to say you open up your statement and you take a look at your statement and you say, hey, wait a minute, how come I'm losing money? I'm in conservatively oriented investments. I have municipal bonds. I shouldn't be losing money. All bonds, all places will mark to market. That is to say, they price those bonds according to what they likely would get in the marketplace on any given day. And that will take into account an increase in interest yields, which means a decrease in prices. And for those municipal bonds, a 1% increase in interest yields will result in about a 7% decline in principal value. Okay, so just because you have a good rate, just because it's a good municipal bond, just because you're getting a nice yield on it, does not mean that you are insulated from the possibility of seeing declines in your portfolio. What do you do about it? Well, there's a number of things you can do about it. One is you can rebalance a portfolio if it's appropriate. Another is that you go ahead and you do hold to maturity. What we like to do here is we like to ladder our fixed income. By ladder, what we mean is we have step ups. So we go ahead and we buy fixed income instruments that have a very short duration and then longer durations, and so that we always have something coming due that can be used to purchase the newest fixed income yield. That means as interest rates are going up, we're always taking advantage of that higher yield.
So we're reducing the interest rate risk and lost opportunity costs.
Absolutely. But another thing to go, hey, look, you know, when you take a look at the pullback we've had here, we've had a number of down days in the overall market. That means that the yields on a lot of these common stocks have come down. Let's talk, for example, the municipals that you're yielding 3% obviously have a nice tax equivalent yield. But when we go ahead and we just match up yield to yield, let's take corporates, for example, a 10-year corporate yielding 3.25%. Okay. That's going to have a substantial downside risk. You take a look at General Electric, for example, as a common stock. Okay. Currently being on a bit of a pullback at this point in time. It's a stock that we do own in our portfolios. We've owned it for some time, and we're looking at possible opportunities to add to our ownership of General Electric. They're a great company. Obviously, they're a large cap blend. They're oriented in an industrial sector. They have a lot of financials as well as a lot of other industrials, what we call a conglomerate. Okay. And, but you take a look at their valuation. They're a little higher than we would like to go ahead and normally see, but, they're not fully valued. So they still have some opportunity to go ahead and move forward. Decent earnings. And, we're looking at about, you know, a yield of about 3.35. Okay. So here you own a corporate stock. You own a position in a company. You own equity stake in a major industrial conglomerate here. And you also get the yield that you would find attached to a 10-year corporate bond. You know, 3.3 and a quarter on the corporate bond versus 3.35, the current dividend yield out of General Electric. And that isn't too shabby, you know, I think.
I agree, and that's part of what goes into building a portfolio around here, and I would think, I would hope, other places as well. What we'd like to get into now is A couple of stocks out there that we've had our eye on, and in particular, some of the sectors that may be taking hits and others that may be doing well and why. Just some things for you to look for out there if you do have an opportunity to, if you have cash on the sidelines that you might be thinking about doing something with.
Yeah, well, there's always opportunity out there for investments. It just kind of depends upon where we're looking. And when we take a look at some of the overall sectors, one of the things I like to go ahead and take a look at is the bullish percent charts, particularly when we take a look at a point and figure methodology. This is a method of technical analysis, but it's a good way of getting market sentiment. Essentially, it's our way of taking a look at what's the market psychology out there. You know, what does the world think? What does the investing world think of these areas? And when we take a look at this, there's a lot of things that are worth taking a look at. There's, you know, the healthcare industry, there's computers, electricals, the internet, transportations, gaming industries, but some of the areas that are out of favor are just as important to go ahead and take a look at. And in these cases, obviously precious metals is, as you know, you've mentioned this a number of times, are way out of favor, so much so that we want to start looking at them as a possible opportunity to go ahead and start putting some money on, just because of valuations and the fact that they have been beaten down so substantially. But the other areas that seem to be favorites for most folks over the past year or so as investment vehicles and now look a little dubious have been the oils and some of the well, the utilities are still pretty decent, electrical utilities in particular, but it's the it's that refining, that oil area that seems to be called into question. And one of those things that we really need to go ahead and take a look at, because we've had a lot of companies that we've owned for a while, Chevron, ExxonMobil, Kinder Morgan, the pipeline organization that we've been talking about recently, having a fantastic yield. These are areas that we really need to go ahead and kind of reevaluate to say, hey, do these hold opportunities or is it risk that we're facing? Okay. And right now, given where they stand, there seems to be a little more risk than opportunity in the oil sector. One of the things that we've been talking about in the last few weeks is the potential for declines in gasoline prices and how that would affect the overall economy, whether or not we would see a substantial increase in GDP production, simply because a substantial part of the overall producing prices involve oil and oil-based products. And so those are some of those things that we really have to go ahead and keep an eye on. One of the things I like to pull up are the individual charts, and without getting too technical, as it's financial humor, sorry, I should stop that. We take a look at the oils, for example, and we're sitting here at about what we call, we're sitting at about 46 on the bullish percent chart. And this is essentially, if we take a look at it, it's kind of the way of saying how many people are interested in owning this sector and what percentage of them own it, okay? At 46%, we're at a circumstance where a little less than half the people who might be interested in owning oils own oils. But which way is the sentiment moving? And right now we are moving south. It's moving negatively against us, which means that the valuation for oils as a sector the risk essentially is against us. So it's not an area that we would go ahead and look to put significant resources into at this point in time. And matter of fact, we want to go ahead and double check those areas or those stocks that we actually own positions in the oil sector just to see, hey, you know, is this something that we need to reevaluate, double down, or go ahead and pull back on? The oil producers, oil servicers rather, they're sitting at about 56, and they seem to have gone ahead and moderated somewhat. on the decline for their particular sector. So we're seeing an opportunity possibly to go ahead and maybe increase our position in oil servicing while at the same point in time paring back on the oil industry as a whole.
Well, that's the oil sector. And I've always wondered, and we saw this happen in the run-up to the last Olympics where the host country would buy up a lot of oil trying to make things as easy going for their countrymen as possible, but we really haven't seen anything like that. We really haven't seen the Russians buying up a lot of oil, say, the way the Chinese did back during those games. So we really haven't seen any kind of a run-up like that, have we?
Well, no, we haven't really seen that. In particular, you got to keep in mind that China is a consumer of resources, okay, whether it's material, in copper, metals, or oil. They are a consumer. Russia is a producer, particularly in oil. So we're not looking to go ahead and see a substantial buildup of oil reserves in Russia at this point, just simply because of the Olympics. And it is not quite the same saving of face issues that you have with, again, a communist-oriented country versus what is a former communist-oriented country.
Sure. Well, that's well said. When we come back on the other side of the break, we're going to get to some more of the companies we're interested in, and you can stay tuned for that. We'll be back in just a few minutes. This is OV Capital. You're listening to Money at Work on TalkZone.com.
You're listening to Money at Work on TalkZone.com. Back to Steve Memory and Brian Bourdon.
Thank you. Welcome back to this final segment of Money at Work for January 23rd, 2014. If you'd like to get a message to the program, you can get it to us at mail@ovcapital.net. And also, as it turns out, is a pretty good way to set an appointment, which kind of surprised me. I just figured we'd be getting questions on that line, but some folks have wanted to use that to come in and see us, so that you can do that too. We're talking about equities, common stocks, things that we're interested in. And last week, we mentioned Netflix. Earnings hadn't come out, and we were wondering what was going to happen with that. That has been one of the bright spots on the board today, Steve, as Netflix, amid this bloodbath on Wall Street, is up about 16.25% right now. So I thought maybe you'd delve into that, pick it up kind of where we left off last week, and just expand on that a little bit for the listeners.
Sure, absolutely. Well, one of the things we were concerned about Netflix, we had to take a look at them and say, where is the valuation? What are we seeing in the marketplace? Is this a good buy? And quite frankly, last week, we took a look at it and said, hey, given the valuation, given the earnings, they seem to be pretty fully valued at this point in time. And matter of fact, you're looking to go ahead and see more downside risk than you saw upside risk. But one of the things we said is, well, let's go ahead and let's wait for earnings to go and come in, and then see how things go. Well, guess what? Earnings came in, and they had a banner month, or banner quarter rather, for going ahead and getting subscribers. I guess they've gone ahead and they've had some promotions, but we see further this move away from DVDs and actually owning individual discs, if you will, or video. And we see that the streaming is really kind of the way it's going. And in particular, it's we've seen some strong performance out of the original content that Netflix has. And so, whether it's Arrested Development or some of the other programs that are out there that are Golden Globe winners at this point, we've had good results from that. Unfortunately, we go ahead and we get the earnings, and the first thing that happens is Everybody's been waiting for this thing to come out. And what have the numbers done? Well, it's the after hours trading, and they all went ahead and bumped this thing about 16, 18 percentage points. So you go, well, that's great. What did you have? Well, you either have the opportunity to go ahead and buy on a speculative, take a flyer on it out ahead of time, or you have to wait for something to come through to give it a good, a good price, because we've gone ahead, we've eaten up a lot of the profit that we would have liked to have gone ahead and seen. So, would it have been great? Yeah, it was great 16% ago. But now what do we got as valuation? Well, so we got another 10% maybe on the upside, I think. Right now it still is kind of fluctuating a bit. But the question is do you go ahead and do you take a flyer at this level? Look, there are always stocks that are going to move. They're going to move on speculation. They're going to move on momentum. They're going to move on market psychology. I don't care if it's Netflix, if it's Facebook, if it's Yahoo, if it's Google, if it's Apple, if it's Krispy Kreme donuts. Okay, the fact is there are always going to be those things that people like to talk about at the water cooler and at their cocktail party. And these things are going to move based upon that. But you can't go ahead and use that as a basis for investing in something.
No, that's exactly right, because I'm facing the same thing. I've got a person or two that is just on me. When should I get into NUS? When should I get into Nu Skin? And my feeling is like, well, how about never? Because it's just, and it's counterintuitive, because as money managers, OV Capital, Steve Member, you're supposed to be getting people into the market, investing for them. And in all candor, we're kind of sitting here last week hoping that Netflix earnings, their report, all that was going to be somewhat tepid, because we were looking at, like you said, folks going away from, the DVDs, things like that. That was what was going to drive it. And, that was kind of in the offing. That was coming along.
Well, we also had the ruling from the Supreme Court about net neutrality. The fact remains that there are broadband providers who Netflix have to go through to end up getting its ultimate distribution. Okay. And they have the ability to be treated differently than you or I do, which is to say that, I'm on the internet quite a bit, and, you are. I'm sitting here looking at stocks all the time, and I use up a lot of bandwidth, but I don't use Netflix-type bandwidth. I'm not sitting here pushing movies down a pipe, okay? So they may wish to charge me a little bit more for a bundle, but the amount of additional funds that they could go ahead and charge somebody like Netflix could be substantial. Now, the Netflix CEO came out and says, and I think there's something to be said about this, that he doesn't necessarily see a substantial penalty at this point in time for Netflix in the marketplace. And that's significant, because what he sees is rather that broadband providers would like to see broadband content, because the more broadband content is out there, the more likely it is that they have the ability to sell or upsell the end consumer on a better pipe usage, essentially the ability to go ahead and download stuff faster. So you want to go ahead and provide that. Netflix being the single largest provider, I guess, at this point in time of broadband content. So, there's Hulu and some other things like that as well. But Netflix right now, I guess, they're in a good position from a growth standpoint. So what does that mean? Does that mean it's a good owning? Does it mean it's a good buy? Look, I think if you're taking a look on a fundamental valuation right now, you don't really justify it based upon the earnings, simply because everybody went ahead and jumped in on all over it, and there wasn't much chance to get it. Institutional guys were all over this thing in a heartbeat. Okay. But that said, what are the long-term prospects for Netflix? I'm coming around to the point in time where I think, they may be pretty decent. And if you're looking for a 5-year hold on something, then you're less likely to be concerned about the last 53 points, which is kind of tough for me to say. You know, I don't know. But again, it's, you know, the long-term trend seems to be in their favor. From a long-term perspective, okay, I got it. From a near-term perspective, quite frankly, they're pretty well fully valued. There's not much there. From a long-term perspective, you know, if you got the 5 years to go ahead and hold it, yeah, take a look at Netflix.
Well, they are trading an astronomical amount of shares today. And if you look at it, it's 22. Take a look at it. It's just it's
11 million changing hands. Average daily volume about 3.8. That's what three, four times their average daily volume.
Yeah, which and when you're looking at that,
I'm not in on it. I mean, we wouldn't do this. You know that.
That's a lot of day trading.
Yeah, well, we're still below the 52-week high, right? Of almost 395.
Right. So it's got a way to go, and it's probably now with the earnings it has, it's going to be more along the 420, 430 before you consider it fully valued.
Yeah, you know, but even so, the thing is, from our perspective, unless you're an aggressive speculative investor, I can't say that this would be a good opportunity. Look, you can't go. It's got some nice technicals to it. It's got a lot of momentum in its favor. It's got a decent support level from a market psychological aspect of things. It's got a lot of buzz, if you will, from the overall industry. But when it comes down to the fundamentals, I'm still sitting there saying, yeah. Look, I can't justify it on a fundamental basis.
Okay, we got a couple of minutes left, maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes. Is there anything else you want to, anything else you're looking out that you'd like to hit on before we take off?
Well, there's plenty of stuff that's out there. You know, I mean, there's Coca-Cola was one of those things that I was going to go ahead and be bringing up. But I think really, quite frankly, we probably don't have enough time to go ahead and get into it. Suffice it to say that the yield on Coke is fairly decent. And in this kind of an environment, you know, what are we looking at dividend-wise? Dividend yield, 2.81%, and valuation being up in the 45-46% or $46 range. We're still looking at about $6-7 a share out of it. So we're probably in about the 17% before fully valued. That's not too bad, given the current environment, given the decent dividend on the stock. That it's not an overly volatile position to go ahead and be in. It has a beta of what 0.52. So, with an environment where the market looks a little skittish, it's not a bad defensive position to go ahead and be in.
Thanks a lot, Steve. That's going to bring our show today to a conclusion. We're happy that you could join us. Tune in again next Thursday at 2. We're going to talk about maximizing IRA contributions, what that means to you from a tax-wise standpoint, and also talk about required minimum distributions if you're in that chapter of your financial life. So thank you for joining us here on Money at Work from OV Capital Management on TalkZone.com.